breakdown. He'd always tried to stay on the right side of the law in his work for LaRue, he said, but somewhere along the way, his sense of right and wrong had warped. Morally, I knew it was wrong, he said. I lost the plot. McConnell told me that after leaving the organization, he began moving locations with his family, hoping there was no one on his tail. Eventually, his paranoia eased, and he started working security again. He stopped hearing from LaRue, and in 2013, he decided to go to the authorities with what he knew. He wrote a letter detailing what he believed to be LaRue's crimes. Afraid that no agency in the Philippines could be trusted, he arranged for a friend to hand-deliver the letter to the U.S. Embassy in Manila, with instructions not to give it to any non-American staff. He never heard back. I caught up with him as he was trying again to switch sides, this time with a Philippine intelligence agency. McConnell had maintained copies of records about LaRue's wealth, including his purchases of gold bars and of land that he'd bought in Western Australia. He estimated that there were $16 million in gold left in the Philippines alone, and his plan was to help the agency and other countries confiscate LaRue's assets. In turn, he believed he would earn their protection against extradition to the United States. "I'm meeting with my handler today," he said. "I'm not asking for money. I think I'm doing the right thing. I want to help, with what little I know, to destroy what Paul LaRue has left." He wasn't the only one trying to find LaRue's stashes. He'd heard talk of South African contractors showing up to ransack LaRue's houses and dig up backyards. Corrupt Philippine law enforcement agencies, McConnell said, were desperately searching the country for their own share. He likened it to Yamashita's gold, a supposed stash of war loot left behind by General Tomoyuki Yamashita when the Japanese fled the Philippines during World War II. Countless prospectors had lost themselves to an obsession with finding it, wrecking their lives in a vain search for a treasure that was long gone, if it had ever been there at all. Chapter 31. The Mastermind. 2016. Giving up the fight. A shroud of secrecy. LaRue on the stand. An Iranian connection. Federal cases often take years to wend their way to a jury, and very few ever make it there. 95% end in a guilty plea, largely because most defendants lack the wherewithal to face the power of a federal prosecution, particularly one with the kinds of resources that had been brought to bear on the likes of Paul LaRue's collaborators. Each member of the North Korean meth group faced multiple charges of conspiring to import drugs to the United States. Hunter, Gogol, and Venvakias were accused of graver crimes, including conspiracy to murder a federal law enforcement agent and an informant. Siborski and Filter were hit with drug charges related to the Bahamas cocaine shipment for which they had provided surveillance. At first, it appeared that Joseph Hunter's case might bring LaRue into the light. Hunter's court-appointed attorney, a New York criminal defense lawyer named Marlon Curtin, planned an unconventional defense that would use the government's own prized witness against them. In January 2015, he filed a motion asking the judge to dismiss the case against Hunter, alleging that the use of LaRue as an informant amounted to outrageous conduct on the part of the government. In the filing, Curtin appeared to be laying the foundation for a rarely used, and even more rarely successful, defense known as duress. A claim of duress argues, essentially, that a defendant committed a crime because he faced an imminent threat of serious bodily harm or death. A person could be found innocent of a crime, in other words, if someone held a loaded gun to his head and told him to commit it. Hunter, the argument went, had gone along with the assassination plan only because he believed LaRue would kill him if he refused. Years before either man was arrested, Hunter claimed, LaRue had threatened him and his family over a gold deal gone bad. And Hunter was in a unique position to know that LaRue followed through on his threats. Mr. Blank literally killed and threatened his associates with the full knowledge of his other associates, Curtin wrote in the motion. LaRue's name was still officially sealed, and Curtin was required to blank it out, despite the fact that the New York Times had revealed it a month earlier. How then can law enforcement use this man to engage the same person as part of a reverse sting operation? What choice did Mr. Hunter have? The answer is death. Hunter's argument was a thin reed, laced with the freakish irony that a man who had carried out hits for LaRue claimed to be doing so out of fear of LaRue's hitmen. But given the evidence against Hunter, it appeared to be the only read available. Federal prosecutors in the Southern District of New York responded that even if LaRue had threatened Hunter, it happened long ago. Hunter had ample time to quit the organization and go to the police. Indeed, he himself admitted to having left the organization for a time, returning after his former boss, Dave Smith, was murdered. Scott Stammers, in the North Korean methamphetamine case, made motions suggesting he might also pursue a duress defense. His lawyer demanded that the prosecution hand over, among other evidence, all threats made by blank to Scott Stammers, and all killings carried out at the directive of blank. But ultimately, both Hunter and Stammers would end up where most federal defendants do. Several weeks after Curtin's filing, before the judge in the case had even ruled on it, Hunter changed his plea to guilty. 6 months later, in August 2015, Stammers followed suit. Eventually, all 10 defendants across both cases would do the same, pleading guilty and throwing themselves on the mercy of the court. By the beginning of 2016, I'd been following these cases for 2.5 years, and LaRue's name had never so much as been mentioned in an open courtroom. In court, lawyers for the defendants in New York were not only required to redact his name in filings, but to use elaborate hypotheticals to discuss anything related to LaRue. Imagine that you have the Godfather, one attorney proposed to the judge, in a lengthy back and forth in open court. A man who's immersed in the most horrific and pronounced crimes you can think of, including murders, and this Godfather has his own security team that's involved in helping him carry out murders in organized crime. At first, the fanatical secrecy made sense. Through at least mid-2014, LaRue was essentially an undercover DEA operative in U.S. custody. By virtue of his cooperation, agents were able to build their elaborate sting operations around the fiction that he was still out in the world. It was essential that his subordinates believe LaRue was still free, calling the shots. But once the underlings had been arrested, the utility of that fiction evaporated. After his name became international news in December 2014, it was rendered ridiculous. LaRue might have been able to convince Oz that a 2013 Brazilian newspaper story about him was fake news, but the revelation in the New York Times that he was in U.S. custody ended his life as pretend drug boss. Still, the government guarded facts about LaRue with the same zealous secrecy, propelled by an internal logic that was itself closed to interrogation. His name might have been public, but LaRue's case file remained sealed. So too did significant portions of the prosecution's case against Hunter and his team of would-be assassins, the group arrested for trafficking North Korean meth, and the RX Limited defendants indicted in Minnesota. Even the name of LaRue's defense attorney was treated like a state secret. In a closed proceeding in August 2013, LaRue had dispensed with Marv Ennie, his appointed attorney, and hired a New York criminal lawyer named B. Allen Seidler. "I was on the case for a while, and now I'm not," was all Marv Ennie would tell me when I reached him by phone. Sometime later, LaRue fired Seidler too, hiring another attorney whose name was sealed. No one I spoke with, including a former federal prosecutor who had worked on sensitive terrorism cases, could find any precedent for sealing an attorney's name when the defendant's name was public. What made the maneuver even more mystifying was that LaRue's new attorney wasn't appointed by the court. He was being paid by LaRue, out of what funds was anyone's guess, and could quit the case anytime he wished. Now, as one defendant after another folded and admitted his guilt, any hope I'd had that LaRue himself might ever be called to testify seemed to be draining away. But there was one defendant whose attorneys thought they had a way to bring LaRue into the open. "The government is embarrassed," Robert Richman, one of Moran Oz's attorneys, told me when I traveled to Minneapolis to interview Oz in December 2015. "They don't want to admit that LaRue was involved." Richman and the other half of Oz's defense team, Joe Friedberg, had started to think their client had the basis for a duress defense. Oz, after all, had been thrown off a boat and shot at by LaRue's henchmen. The only problem was that Linda Marks, the Department of Justice lawyer prosecuting the case, exhibited no intention of calling LaRue as a witness, much less making him available to Oz's attorneys for a deposition. At first, their attempts to gain access to LaRue amounted to legal filings mocking the government's absurd level of secrecy. When they'd asked to speak to LaRue's attorney, the prosecutor told them that counsel for LaRue has requested anonymity because he fears for his safety from international associates of Mr. LaRue, Richman and Friedman wrote in a brief. Given that Mr. LaRue is more dangerous than any of his associates, one wonders whether the masked attorney has identified himself to his own client. Perhaps even Mr. LaRue does not know the identity of his attorney, with all meetings conducted in a confessional, perhaps, or with a curtain separating the two. Voice disguised. When they'd suggested they might subpoena LaRue, Marks had replied that they could do so only if he's in the United States, and then refused to indicate whether he was. "We feel reasonably confident that Mr. LaRue is somewhere on planet Earth, but that is only an inference," Richman and Friedman wrote. Wherever he was, they argued that it should be LaRue who was facing a jury, not underlings like Oz. The government's use of Mr. LaRue as an informant is even more egregious here because the government has cut a deal with the principal architect and leader of the alleged criminal enterprise while prosecuting his employees, they concluded. It is as if Microsoft was a criminal enterprise and the government cuts a deal with Bill Gates to take down the entire shipping department. Mockery aside, the filings were part of a serious legal gambit that Richmond and Friedman thought might force the government's hand. The case against Oz was based in part on calls between LaRue in U.S. custody and Oz in Israel. Digging through the evidence, Richmond realized that the U.S. Attorney's Office had recorded them without a warrant. So he filed a motion to have the material suppressed, arguing that U.S. federal law required that at least one party consent to a recorded phone call. Richmond knew that Oz certainly hadn't given his permission. Had LaRue? The government produced statements from DEA agents saying that he had. But Richmond and Friedberg argued that if the government wanted to prove LaRue did so voluntarily, the man himself would need to say it under oath. Defendant Murad Oz moves for an order requiring the government to produce its favorite informant, Paul Calder LaRue, to testify at the motion hearing, Richmond wrote. After a few weeks of back and forth, in mid-January 2016, the judge finally handed down a decision. It is hereby ordered that Defendant Murad Oz's motion to produce government informant Paul Calder LaRue for a motion hearing is granted. After years of chasing LaRue's shadow, at first online and then around the world, here finally was my chance to see him face to face, at least in a courtroom. I arrived in Minneapolis on a clear, frigid morning in early March. The hearing was across the river in St. Paul, and I ran into Richmond and Friedberg at a cafe beforehand. They showed me a copy of what appeared to be a fake local arrest record for LaRue on cocaine charges, concocted by the Department of Justice as a cover story for his transfer to the Minnesota jail. It was evidence that LaRue was nearby, and of how far federal prosecutors had gone to keep him under wraps. There was also some bad news. LaRue's lawyer filed an emergency motion to seal the courtroom, Richmond told me. In a letter to the court that was itself sealed, the anonymous lawyer argued that LaRue's family would be put in jeopardy by allowing the media to report on the proceedings. Some of LaRue's former employees, like Lachlan McConnell, were still at large and could represent a danger to people close to LaRue. Later, I got a copy of the letter, which amounted to an unusual prosecution-sanctioned list of accusations against LaRue's associates. For example, Chris DeMeyer, a former Special Forces French Foreign Legion sniper, is an unindicted co-conspirator in the Hunter case, the attorney wrote. DeMeyer, known to have access to weapons, is at large and resides approximately 40 minutes from LaRue's ex-wife. DeMeyer also participated in murders with and for Hunter. He was a consistent member of Hunter's murder-for-hire group. He was, the letter asserted, responsible for the murder of Noemi Edelor, shooting her in the head. The judge allowed the press in the courtroom to hear his decision on the sealing order, and I took a seat in the back of the courtroom, alongside some local reporters and Oz's wife, who had moved from Israel with their two kids. A few minutes later, Oz arrived in jeans and a black jacket, wearing the same dark, trim beard as when I'd met him in 2015. For a man about to share a courtroom with the ex-boss who had him shot at and set up, he appeared buoyant. When Richmond showed him a printout of LaRue's fake local arrest record, he laughed aloud. Linda Marks, the prosecutor, had dark, swept-back hair and was wearing a black suit, sitting with another prosecutor at a table across the courtroom. They'd both flown in from Washington. The judge opened the hearing by noting the request from LaRue's attorney to close the courtroom. "Let me first turn to Mr. Oz's counsel," he said. "Do you continue to assert your constitutional rights to have an open hearing, Mr. Richmond?" "Yes, Your Honor," Richmond replied. "I find this procedure somewhat baffling. LaRue," he pointed out, "was a government informant. His name was now public, and court hearings are typically sealed only at the behest of the government, not a witness's private attorney." "This is a matter that has generated great interest," Richmond continued. "There are members of the press in the back of the courtroom, as well as Mr. Oz's family." Richmond pointed out that LaRue's identity had been revealed over a year before, and no harm has fallen on the family. And that document also suggests that the government has taken steps to protect the family. The moment had arrived that could decide whether LaRue would be forced to publicly answer for his past, from the pharmacy network to the drug running to the arms shipments to the murders, and for his work on behalf of the U.S. government. "I'm going to deny the request," the judge finally said. "Nothing has been established that would override the strong interest that the defendant has in a public proceeding." And with that, the hearing began. Linda Marks called Special Agent Eric Stouch from the DEA Special Operations Division, who entered in a suit holding a pair of eyeglasses. Stouch testified succinctly to the fact that LaRue had cooperated voluntarily, that he'd been an eager participant in the sting operation. On cross-examination, Richmond, hoping to establish that LaRue had been so desperate for a deal that he had lied about Oz's role, pressed Stouch on whether LaRue had ever been promised that he wouldn't be extradited to another country, or that he would avoid facing the death penalty. Stouch admitted that LaRue had voiced concern about being extradited, but he denied that the government had made him any assurances. Richmond then attempted to drive home another point. After the DEA had arrested LaRue, he asked, wasn't he then allowed to keep operating the same pharmacy network that the United States had sought for years to shut down? The internet pharmacy was still operating, but was winding down, Stouch said. And as part of that process of operating the pharmacy, he was continuing to transfer cash to pay salaries and pay doctors and so on, correct? Richmond asked. He was transferring cash to pay salaries. And that was obviously with the consent of the U.S. government, correct? Yes. So during that period of time, the U.S. government was operating the internet pharmacy, correct? Linda Marks objected, and it wasn't hard to see why. If the government was going to argue that Rx Limited put its customers in danger, they would have to answer for why they had given LaRue access to his money so he could keep it operating, just to let them catch lower-level employees. Overruled, the judge said. No, we were in the process of having him wind it down, Stouch said. It was still operating, and he was paying salaries. Whether the U.S. government was operating the pharmacy, we were in the process of shutting it down. After Stouch, Marks called Travis Okun, a DEA agent from Minneapolis who had helped Brill in the later stages of the Rx Limited case, and had been by LaRue's side when he communicated with Moran Oz. Okun also testified to the fact that LaRue had made the calls voluntarily. Now it was Richmond's turn. Your Honor, he said, we call Paul Calder LaRue. LaRue entered the courtroom through a side door, escorted by two plainclothes United States Marshals. He had a slightly unruly beard that was a darker shade than his silver hair, but otherwise looked surprisingly tropical, in a billowy, lemon-yellow t-shirt and orange correctional pants. He was still a fat man. His fake arrest record listed him at 6 feet, 280 pounds, but he'd lost some weight in his 3.5 years in custody. The marshals unshackled his arms and pointed him to the elevated witness stand. He scanned the courtroom intently as he settled into the chair, as if puzzled by the people who had shown up to see him. For a moment we locked eyes, or at least I thought we did. But his gaze quickly moved on, with an expression of bemused curiosity. If LaRue's anonymous lawyer was in attendance, he didn't make his presence known. So, in what amounted to a contorted legal setup, LaRue, a potential defense witness, was functionally represented by Marks, who offered periodic objections that were indistinguishable from those she might have made for her own witness. Furthering the role reversal, Richmond adopted an approach not unlike that of a prosecutor, questioning a defendant about his crimes. He approached the podium and began by asking LaRue what his profession was. LaRue thought for a moment, then responded in what sounded to my ears like a South African accent, flattened by years abroad, and LaRue's own efforts to shed it. Essentially, he said, I worked as a programmer for many years. The ostensible purpose of the hearing, to establish whether LaRue had consented to recordings of his phone calls with Moran Oz, was accomplished in minutes. But Richmond was after more, and he pushed LaRue to admit to a list of the same facts that I had been chasing for years. He confirmed that he had created the encryption software E4M, but denied that he had developed TrueCrypt, its famous progeny. He copped to some of his aliases, including Johann Smith, Bernard Bolens, and John Smith. He admitted having organized a 200-kilo cocaine shipment on the Gervais out of Ecuador. It was when Richmond began asking about the murders that the casualness of LaRue's admissions became most dissonant. You knew that your legal situation was far worse than just a methamphetamine charge, correct? Richmond asked, probing LaRue's motives for cooperating. In what way? LaRue asked. He leaned back in his chair, his arms folded. Well, for example, you ordered multiple murders, correct? Yes, that's true. And for example, you ordered the murder of a Filipino customs agent, correct? That's not correct, LaRue said, leaning into the microphone and furrowing his brow in mild irritation. There, in the skeptical narrowing of his eyes, he displayed the sense of superiority that I had heard many of his employees and family members describe. What's not correct about it? The individual wasn't a customs agent, LaRue said. It was a trivial objection. The victim in question, Noemi Edelor, was a part-time real estate agent who also worked for LaRue, helping him move items through customs. So it was a real estate agent, correct? Richmond continued. Correct. And then there was a second real estate agent, correct? Correct. who was also murdered on your orders, correct? That's true. There was nothing approaching contrition in his manner, nor a hint of any emotion at all. When LaRue then admitted that he'd also ordered the killing of Dave Smith, his tone was as cold and flat as if he'd just confirmed what he had been served for breakfast. Richmond walked LaRue through his decision to cooperate with the U.S. government, fishing for evidence that he'd done so under pressure from the DEA, or in exchange for promises that he would avoid extradition or the death penalty. The greater the benefit that LaRue expected from the government for his cooperation, the more likely it was that he would lie to help them convict Moran Oz. The government has given no assurances in the plea deal, LaRue replied, sounding well-practiced. They simply state that they will make it known to the court if I'm truthful and I provide information that's of substantial assistance. He acknowledged that when he decided to cooperate on the plane back to the U.S., he'd been formally charged in only the meth deal. The possible sentence was 10 years to life, but as LaRue helpfully pointed out to Richmond, the recommended sentence was only around 12 years. As Richmond tried to maneuver him into admitting that he had cooperated out of fear, LaRue nimbly deflected him. Did LaRue know, Richmond asked, that Adam Simia and David Stilwell were being prosecuted in New York for Catherine Lee's murder, and that if he himself had been charged, he could have faced the death penalty? I'm not aware of how the laws relate to that case, so I couldn't answer that, LaRue said. You don't know whether you could face the death penalty if you were charged with a murder in the United States? I don't know the law here, so I couldn't answer that, LaRue said. If you say so. When it came to other countries' laws, though, LaRue displayed a rather detailed knowledge. He admitted that he was vulnerable to criminal charges in the Philippines and Ecuador, the latter since the cocaine shipment originated there. He'd committed no crimes in Brazil, he said, because it lacks a conspiracy law. As for his adventures in Somalia, he argued, Somalia lacks any government, so I am not concerned about whatever actions took place there because they are not crimes. By this point, Richmond had achieved his goal, and the judge seemed to have reached the limit of the latitude he was willing to grant. Richmond tried one more gambit. Isn't it true that you had a reputation for killing people who stole from you? He asked. That is an exaggeration, LaRue said. Nothing further, Your Honor. After a brief cross-examination, in which Linda Marks re-established that LaRue had agreed to have his phone calls and email monitored, the hearing was over. Two marshals shackled LaRue and escorted him back through the side door. Outside the courtroom, Oz's other attorney, Friedberg, seemed almost triumphant, even though the defense team would ultimately lose the motion to throw out the phone and email records. They'd flushed LaRue out into the open, and if they called him as a witness at Oz's trial, they could easily establish his murderous past through his own admissions. Certainly the phone calls will come into evidence. We always knew that, he said. Getting a look at this guy is worth a lot to us. The hearing had finally breached the wall of secrecy surrounding LaRue, or at least a section of it. The same day, a federal judge in New York unsealed a portion of his case file in the Southern District. The docket showed that LaRue had formally pleaded guilty after a year of cooperation at the end of 2013. His final plea deal remained sealed, but the information he had signed was now available. There, at last, were the criminal counts that LaRue was on the hook for: the meth importation plan, computer hacking, and bribery of a foreign official. The information also included crimes that he'd admitted but would never be prosecuted for, including that he had solicited or participated in 7 murders. The names were redacted, but it wasn't hard for me to fill them in. Dave Smith, Noemi Edelor, Catherine Lee, Joe Frank Zuniga, Bruce Jones, Herbert Tan Chu, and Cheeto, the man who had tipped off the Philippine police to Chu's gun stash. Kent Bailey told me that LaRue denied ordering the daylight assassination of Michael Lontoc, the Philippine target shooter who ran the organization's gun shop in Manila, claiming someone else killed him over a gambling debt. There was another remarkable fact in LaRue's unsealed docket, one that held the key to the incredible secrecy surrounding him. LaRue had confessed to selling technology to the government of Iran, a crime in the United States. Finally, I understood why LaRue had been treated like a national security asset. He was one. Or at least, a potential asset. Later, I learned from the former 960 agent that the DEA hadn't been able to turn LaRue's information about Iran into actionable intelligence. We were trying to work with the FBI, it just didn't go anywhere, he said. The Obama administration, he said, refused to allow the DEA to send anyone into Iran to pick up the trail of LaRue's contacts. And they'd missed out on Nestor Del Rosario, who had approached the Australians willing to cooperate before he disappeared. I don't blame him, the former agent said. I wish we would have talked to him, because he's the one who could really spell out the whole Iranian situation. LaRue's North Korean connections, via a Chinese triad group, similarly fizzled. Yi Tiong-tan Lim, the man convicted in the North Korean meth sting, had declined to cooperate, leaving the DEA with no path into the organization. Lim plays a role of a poor, little old guy, the former 960 agent said. Lim is legit. He's scared his family would be murdered, and he's probably right. We just never got far with him. We needed him, because we didn't understand it, and we would have had to go into Hong Kong. They don't like the Americans. LaRue had leveraged his way into a deal with the U.S. government based on a promise that had largely dissolved into vapor, aside from the former employees he'd helped set up. Kent Bailey, for one, believed that the 960 agents had been starstruck by headline-grabbing possibilities and let themselves believe that LaRue could deliver something bigger than himself. These are the countries that are in the news. These are hot frickin' items, Bailey said. His pipe dream was that he was dealing directly with some general in the Iranian army, and Iran was talking about building missiles for nuclear weapons. But people in that world think they are bigger than they are. Chapter 32. The Trial. 2016 to 2017. The Observer Effect. Kent Bailey in the flesh. McConnell gets pinched. RX Limited on trial. An outcome foretold. In the spring of 2016, I published a series of articles about LaRue online, in the Atavist magazine, laying out the still incomplete picture of what I'd learned. The stories, which unfolded at the pace of one article a week between March and May, generated an influx of new sources. Each time a new article went online, I'd hear from people eager to relay their own LaRue experiences. Some tips came in the form of cryptic emails from anonymous sources, offering secrets that went far beyond what I'd reported. A manila envelope arrived at my house containing a foreign government's intelligence report on LaRue. Someone who claimed to have ties to the U.S. Embassy in Manila wrote with information about the status of Lachlan McConnell. A whistleblower at an investment firm in Hong Kong contacted me to provide information on LaRue's financial records, and LaRue's relatives emailed with stories of the confident young genius they had known. These I had mostly expected. What I hadn't anticipated were the ways in which I now became a minor participant in the drama myself. It was, in part, a byproduct of the wall of secrecy the U.S. government had constructed around LaRue. To the extent that I had pierced it slightly, building on revelations in the New York Times and elsewhere, I'd filled a vacuum that the government had created. Defense attorneys who had been denied any information about LaRue began citing my articles in their court filings, hoping to mitigate the crimes to which their clients had pleaded guilty. Scott Stammer's attorney submitted the articles as evidence that there was no organization, as alleged by the government, in which Mr. Stammer's was a manager. Instead, there was one person, LaRue, who orchestrated crimes of a massive scale. Philip Shackle's attorney argued that his client lived in fear of LaRue. This is corroborated, as we point out in our papers, by reporting by different sources, including the Atavist, he wrote. Joseph Hunter's attorney pointed to the articles as evidence that no statements from LaRue should be believed on their face. One day at a hearing in the RX Limited case, I puzzled over the familiarity of a photo presented by a defense attorney, only to realize that I had taken it, and then had sent it to the lawyer, hoping to get his client to verify the location. Throughout my reporting on LaRue, I had the experience of becoming simultaneously a seeker of information and a source of it. Never before had I chased a story in which so many subjects threw up their hands mid-interview and turned my questions back on me. Could I help them find someone across the world, in the Philippines, or supply a document that a government refused to provide? Could I explain where LaRue was, and whether he would ever be released from prison? I found myself saying over and over, well, I'm not a defense investigator, or I'm not a government agent. But now, after some of my reporting was public, I was experiencing a journalistic analog of what in quantum physics is called the observer effect, the inability of a researcher to study a phenomenon without themselves altering it. My reporting had come full circle in sometimes unsettling ways. I received an email from the ex-girlfriend of a defendant who contacted me to say that she had a laptop that he'd given her years before. It had a separate user login, protected by a password she didn't know. She wanted to find out if she had to send it to the police, or if she could just send it to me. After consulting with an attorney, I told her I didn't think that she was required to do anything with it. But given that I couldn't crack it myself, her choices were to contact the U.S. Attorney's Office or to keep quiet about it. She chose the former, and I later heard that Thomas Sindrick from SOD flew out to her home to retrieve it. I heard, too, from an accountant in Florida who found my name in a search for Robert McGowan, the Zimbabwean I'd written about. The accountant, who specialized in finding and obtaining lost corporate assets, said he had discovered unclaimed money related to a former company he registered here in the United States. As the sole director, McGowan would be entitled to reclaim his lost assets. He said the amount was around $50,000. I couldn't locate a journalistic ethics guide that addressed the situation, so I just forwarded the note on to McGowan and left it to him whether to take LaRue's forgotten money. After all, his name had been listed, without his knowledge, on the incorporation papers. Maybe it was poetic justice. Before one of my trips to Manila, Joseph Hunter let it be known through an associate that he was concerned about my safety. "Be careful," he said. I had trouble processing the idea that the former head of an international kill team was now telling me, out of concern for my welfare, to watch my back. Hunter also relayed a request that I pick up some notebooks and mixed martial arts DVDs he'd left behind in Manila with a friend. Worried that I was being set up, I offered to meet the contact in a public place to look at the items. The contact never showed. In April 2016, an anonymous tipster emailed to say that Lachlan McConnell had been detained in the Philippines and was facing deportation. For a moment I wondered if it had been my articles that had prompted this, but the truth was much more mundane. Unable to persuade the Philippines to extradite him, the United States had pressured Canadian authorities to cancel his passport. Interpol had issued a red notice for McConnell's arrest, and without a valid passport, he was no longer legally allowed to remain in the country. The Philippine police arrested him on immigration charges at his office in Makati, near where he and I had met. A few months later, he arrived in Minnesota. Thunderclouds were gathering over the Minneapolis skyline on the afternoon I walked into Psycho Susie's Motor Lounge, a tiki bar hugging a bank of the Mississippi just across from downtown. Kent Bailey was already seated at a table out back, overlooking the river. I'd come to town after months of trying to pin him down for an interview, and spent a day waiting for him to break free from a case. "I'm out on the street with my group," he texted me. "We have a search and arrest warrant we need to serve. Of course, we are on doper time." Now he said he had a few hours before an agent's going away party. 1 minute after I sat down, the skies opened up and we hustled inside. I asked him why he was finally willing to talk now. He was planning to retire in a year, he said. Kimberly Brill was the real brains behind the operation anyway, and he wanted to give her the credit she was too modest to take. "The other thing is, you know what? I ain't hiding anything," he said. "You know what I mean? It is what it is. I think that the story deserves to be put out there." Bailey walked me through the case, from Kimberly Brill and Stephen Holdren's first bust of Alt Geld, the Chicago pharmacy, to his travels around the world seeking foreign cooperation, to watching the Gervais sail off across the Pacific. "Over the years, I've prided myself on working the biggest and best cases," he said. "LaRue is the guy. He's the smartest drug dealer I've ever faced." Now, though, Bailey seemed concerned that the case against RX Limited's employees was dragging on, with no trial dates in sight. Of the 11 original defendants, 3 had taken deals and pleaded guilty, including John Wall, the Israeli-American who'd worked as LaRue's shipper in Kentucky. In exchange for testifying against Oz and the remaining defendants, prosecutors allowed him to plead guilty to one of his 23 counts, carrying a maximum of 5 years in prison. 3 more RX Limited figures were still at large. Omer Bezalel, the Israeli who'd worked with McConnell in Florida, had, like Oz, been lured to Romania and then extradited to Minnesota. But after he was released on bail to a halfway house, he walked away, presumably returning to Israel, beyond the reach of American authorities. Alon Berkman was in hiding. Shai Reuven, according to beach and nightclub photos he posted on Facebook, seemed to be living unperturbed in the Philippines. That left 5 defendants who had refused to take plea deals. Moran Oz and Lachlan McConnell, who were accused of handling operations for the network, Prabhakar Tumpati and another Pennsylvania doctor, Elias Karkalis, who'd written prescriptions for it, and the pharmacist in Detroit, Babapai Patel, who was already serving a 17-year sentence for healthcare fraud. Charles Schultz, like most of the other pharmacists, was indicted in his home state. He pleaded to a single count of conspiracy to distribute controlled substances. "I only have myself to blame," he said in court. A judge fined him $350,000, but declined to impose jail time due to Schultz's failing health. "The prosecution of him was an act of cruelty," his lawyer Hal Harlow told me. "He was old and infirm. He had gone through his whole life with a good reputation. I think convicting an 82-year-old man to have another notch in their belt was unfortunate." I asked Bailey why the myriad other people involved in the organization at different levels, from Levy Kugel to Tomer Taggart, escaped indictment. Why prosecute this group among the many people who'd arguably played serious roles in the business? There is always going to be somebody who, by the grace of God, missed it, Bailey said. It comes down to prosecutorial discretion. The investigators had made their argument, he said, barely containing his bitterness. The prosecutors had chosen the targets. Everyone else was going to skate. A trial date for Oz and McConnell was finally set for early 2017, almost 3 years after Paul LaRue had lured Oz to Romania for the sting, and nearly 10 since Kimberly Brill and Stephen Holdren had first started poking into RX Limited. They were going to be tried together, alongside the pair of RX Limited doctors from Pennsylvania, Karkalis and Timpati. Linda Marks's team still refused to make information about LaRue available, despite the fact that he was the world's most knowledgeable person about RX Limited, and already in U.S. custody. But if the government was doing everything in its power to keep LaRue out of the trial, the defense attorneys were planning to make him the star of it. On the morning of February 7th, I arrived at the courthouse in St. Paul for the opening day of the trial, in the courtroom of Judge Susan Richard Nelson. The gallery was sparsely populated, no more than a half dozen people, and over the weeks of the trial I would become familiar with my fellow attendees, Oz's wife and a rabbi who came along for support, an occasional local reporter, and, on most days, Kimberly Brill from the DEA. The real action was at the attorneys' tables, where each of the four defendants was flanked by a pair of lawyers, and where Linda Marks sat with her team of three prosecutors. The case of Patel, the Detroit pharmacist, had been severed from the others that morning, and his charges were later dropped. All four of these defendants are charged with conspiring to distribute prescription drugs over the internet without valid prescriptions, U.S. Attorney Roger Garral said in his opening statement to the jury. Defendants' internet operation was not designed to provide medical supervision. It was designed to make money. And some of these defendants made a lot of money. He painted a picture of a conspiracy operating without regard for either the laws of the United States or the safety of customers. It was quick, just provide a name, a shipping address, what drug you wanted, the quantity you wanted, your credit card information, and a reason for ordering, and a few days later, your drugs would show up at your doorstep. You will hear a lot about Paul LaRue, but he's not on trial here, Garral continued. This trial is about these four defendants and their conduct, which was to create an international network of website operators, business managers, doctors, and pharmacies that agree to work together to sell massive quantities of prescription drugs to customers in the United States. Each of the defendants intended to offer a variation on an unconventional defense. They would freely admit to most of the facts as Garral had laid them out. Oz, McConnell, Timpati, and Karkalis had all clearly participated in RX Limited in their various capacities. But since they believed what they were doing was legal, they weren't culpable, even if it turned out they'd been wrong. As far as Moran Oz knew, the company and everything he did for the company was completely legal, his attorney, Robert Richman, said in his opening statement. In a different type of criminal trial, for murder, say, or robbery, such a defense would be impossible. Murder is murder, even if you somehow don't know murder is illegal. But the charges brought against Oz and his fellow defendants required what's called mens rea, knowledge on the part of the accused that they are breaking the law. Oz's and McConnell's attorneys both planned an additional gambit. They would use the duress defense that Hunter had briefly floated before he pleaded guilty. Oz and McConnell, the narrative went, had both done LaRue's bidding because they feared that if they defied him, he would kill them. Oz's defense would hinge on the boat incident in Subic Bay. McConnell's, constructed by the husband and wife defense team of Marie and Ryan Pasiga, would center on the killing of his friend Dave Smith and LaRue's subsequent statement, "I didn't need Dave, you're lucky I need you." To support their duress defenses, they would do what the prosecution would not, put Joseph Hunter and Paul LaRue on the stand. "You have heard that RX Limited was owned by Paul Calder LaRue," Richman told the jury. "What the government neglected to mention to you is that Paul Calder LaRue is a ruthless, vicious, international criminal. He is a murderer, a drug dealer, and a weapons smuggler. The U.S. government arrested Paul LaRue in 2012. He is now in federal prison. He should be the one on trial here, but instead he cut a deal with the government to cooperate. The prosecution has hardly even mentioned Paul LaRue, but we are going to call him to testify in this trial because we want you to know the full story." On a break the first morning of the trial, Oz and I greeted each other just outside the courtroom. He projected the same warm confidence as he had on our first meeting back in December 2015. "I still can't believe I'm here and he got a deal," he said of LaRue. He wasn't allowed to work in the United States under the conditions of his bail, so he occupied much of his time studying the Torah. He and his wife had a third child while he'd been awaiting trial. "I'm getting to spend a lot of time with my kids, which I wouldn't get to do in Israel," he said. I asked him if he'd ever considered running, like Bezalel and Berkman had. "No, that's not me. I want to face it because I didn't do anything wrong. I have a family. I have kids. I can't spend my life looking over my shoulder." From the opening day, the prosecution's case felt muddled, formless. At times, they seemed uncertain about what story they were telling. The RX Limited Network was a tangled ecosystem of websites, affiliates, doctors, pharmacists, and customer service centers, driven by technology that was not always simple to explain. Each of the defendants represented a different part of that ecosystem, but the story of their guilt always seemed just out of reach. Marx and her colleagues were sitting on a mountain of evidence, but it quickly became clear that much of it would be useless. Without putting LaRue on the stand to testify to how it all worked and who did what, they were left to connect fragments of disparate dots themselves. Making matters worse, the prosecutors seemed inexperienced in basic trial procedures. Over and over, Judge Nelson sustained defense objections to the prosecution's evidence, as third-hand information contained in emails or asserted by witnesses, at one point stopping to explain to them the basic principle of what constituted hearsay evidence. If the prosecution was going to convince the jury, it would have to be through its star witnesses, the federal agents who worked on the case. On the second day, Stephen Holdren meticulously explained how the RX Limited model worked and how he and Brill had first uncovered it. But even basic questions about the controlled buys unavoidably devolved into technical arcana. Holdren: the receipt contained an address, systemca.com. Question: and what, if anything, did you find out about systemca.com? Holdren: conducted a whois search. Whois is a public database that allows you to identify the owner of a domain name or an IP address. So I conducted a whois search on systemca.com and also cardadmin.com that was observed during the payment process and discovered that both names were registered by the domain name registrar AB Systems. Question: and so that's what led you to request records from ICANN on AB Systems? Holdren: correct. All of it was fascinating and certainly would have implicated Paul LaRue had he been the one on trial, but he wasn't. He was the man the prosecutors were desperately trying to keep out of the courtroom. It was as if the government had decided to proceed with the case they would have tried against LaRue instead of the one they were left with, the case against his underlings. Kimberly Brill testified twice over the course of the prosecution's case. Each was long and grueling. First, she was questioned for multiple days by the prosecution, then cross-examined by four separate defense attorneys in turn. On the stand, she seemed calm and practiced, if sometimes annoyed at the questions. "No, I did not record the call," she said at one point, cutting off an elaborate sequence of queries from Robert Richman about an undercover phone buy. "So you're feeling a little defensive about the fact that you did not record the call, I take it," he replied. "I don't feel defensive," she said, smiling tightly. "I just knew where you were going." But her tone sometimes registered the same friendly irritation with her own prosecutors as she displayed to their opponents. Even in Brill's testimony, Marx and Garal quickly ran headlong into the original challenge that the DEA investigators had faced at the start of the case. The drugs sold by RX Limited weren't listed as controlled. Much of the prosecution hinged on the idea that Fioricet, one of the big three drugs sold by RX Limited, could be classified as a controlled substance. The reality was more complicated. One ingredient in it, butalbital, was indeed a Schedule III controlled substance. But Fioricet, which combined barbituric acid with caffeine and Tylenol, was trapped in a gray area. So gray, in fact, that Brill was forced to admit on the stand that she'd had to consult a lawyer at the DEA to determine Fioricet's status. Gray enough that, as the defense gleefully pointed out, the head of the DEA himself had testified before Congress, right in the middle of the LaRue investigation in 2011, that Fioricet was exempted from the law. Partway through their own prosecution, the government gave up on the argument and dropped the portion of the charges related to controlled drugs. That still left dozens of charges against the four defendants, just based on the fact that they'd prescribed drugs without a doctor's visit. But prosecutors would still have to show that operators like Oz and McConnell knew that what they were doing was illegal. The testimony of John Wall, LaRue's former shipping manager from Kentucky, who had taken a plea deal, represented their best hope of doing so. It started off well enough, with Wall describing how he had worked for LaRue's call centers in the Philippines. He testified that he knew Oz handled money for RX Limited, and that the one time they met in the Philippines, they had played poker. He recounted how, back in the United States, he had been LaRue's go-to shipper, buying everything from planes and boats to logging equipment and art. When LaRue had charged him with recruiting pharmacies in the States, he said, he started to believe what he was doing was illegal. The obvious implication was that the other RX Limited employees should have drawn the same conclusion. On cross-examination by Oz's lawyer Friedberg, however, Wall lost his footing. At first, Friedberg seemed to be goading him into talking as much as possible about LaRue. Friedberg, could you list for the jury the friends you're aware that Mr. LaRue had? Wall, when you say friends, what do you mean? Friedberg, I don't know if I can do any better than that. Did you know of him to ever have a friend? Wall, not really. Friedberg, okay, do you know why? Wall, I guess people didn't like him very much. Friedberg, why? Wall, he was unpleasant to be around often. Friedberg, all right. You apparently handled some lawsuits for him, did you not? Wall, just one. Friedberg, how did you do that? Wall, it was pretty easy. He bribed the judge. Friedberg, did you know he bribed the judge? Wall, yes. Friedberg, how did you know he bribed the judge? Wall, the attorney told me. But then, when pressed on how he'd known the prescription drug business was illegal, Wall dropped a bombshell. LaRue had once told him so, on the phone. Within minutes of making the statement, the defense attorneys had shredded his testimony with a simple observation that he'd never mentioned this phone call in any previous sworn statements. Seemingly overeager to show his worth as a witness, Wall had tripped himself up. The prosecution later had to admit that they had no record of Wall ever making the claim. He'd either lied at the time, or he was lying now. Eventually, Judge Nelson ruled that the jury be instructed to discount Wall's testimony entirely. To incriminate the doctors, the prosecution put forward other former RX Limited physicians and pharmacists, most of whom had taken deals and now testified that they'd always suspected RX Limited was illegal. Among them was Anu Kanakanchi, the doctor whom Prabhakara Tempati had recruited into RX Limited. Back when they were so close, he had called her sister. After 2 weeks, the prosecution rested, and the defense prepared to present their case. Federal marshals flew LaRue to Minneapolis, where he waited in preparation for his own turn on the witness stand. Joseph Hunter was transported out of his federal prison cell in Kansas to Oklahoma, where he awaited a final trip to Minnesota. As the prosecution concluded their case, it appeared headed for a showdown, with Paul LaRue at the center. Still, I couldn't help wondering what I'd just witnessed. Much of the prosecution's case seemed to rely on, as one of Oz's lawyers described it, an aura of mild criminality. Clearly Oz, McConnell, and the doctors were at times eager and willing participants in various facets of RX Limited's operation. But the evidence meant to convince the jury they'd known they were breaking the law was difficult for me to parse, and I'd been following the cases for years. There was a brief lull in the trial as the four defense teams each filed what are called Rule 29 motions, asking the judge to dismiss the case. Such motions, a common defense gambit at the midpoint of a trial, argue that the prosecution has failed to prove its case, even in the absence of any defense. Judge Nelson, in assessing them, was required to consider the evidence presented so far in the light most favorable to the prosecution, essentially, to assume that none of it would be disproven. If the defendant's guilt hadn't been proven beyond a reasonable doubt given that assumption, the judge could find them not guilty immediately. Rule 29 motions are largely pro forma exercises. Several lawyers I spoke to had never seen one succeed in a federal trial in their decades-long careers. No one had reason to believe this case would be any different. Judge Nelson ordered the lawyers to present oral arguments on the motions. Richmond stood up to speak first. Your Honor, in 1987, I became an assistant federal defender in the Boston office, and I've been practicing criminal defense since then, he said. And so it is with a fair number of data points that I say, I have never in my career seen such a complete failure of proof as exists in this case. The flaws in the case were fundamental. The government couldn't prove that email messages they'd relied on were even sent by Oz, much less provide a witness or document showing he knew the operation was illegal. It's not even clear exactly what it is that Ron, or Moran Oz, did, Richmond said. We know that he worked for the company. We know that he had something to do with the pharmacies. He participated in closing orders, negotiating prices. Occasionally he would contact a doctor, There is simply no evidence of criminal intent. To the contrary, the evidence is fairly unequivocal that this was a company that was trying to comply with the law. McConnell's attorneys argued much the same. McConnell had never interacted with doctors or customers, and he knew nothing about the drugs they were receiving. The evidence does not even establish that McConnell understood the RXL business model, among the constellation of other co-occurring Paul LaRue business ventures, the motion declared. The government asserted, instead, that the defendants had been willfully blind to the illegality of RX Limited, that they'd worked hard to avoid knowing that the business was clearly illegal. RX Limited was a pill mill designed to sell addictive prescription drugs, they restated in their response. On a Monday morning in early March 2017, Judge Nelson called the court to order. "Good morning, everybody," she said. "Rule 29 of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure states this court must enter a judgment of acquittal as to any offense for which the evidence is insufficient to sustain a conviction." After a brief review of the law, she turned to the evidence against Oz and McConnell. "Even the most compelling facts presented by the government do not clear the hurdle of reasonable doubt," she concluded. "Therefore, as to Messrs. Oz and McConnell, the Rule 29 motions are granted." They were free to go. The trial would continue for Tempati and Karkalis, she ruled, as there was just enough evidence to force the two doctors to put on a defense. But by this point, the outcome of both cases seemed a foregone conclusion. 1 week later, the jury returned the same verdict for the two doctors, not guilty on all counts. The results were a disaster for Marx's team. After a decade-long investigation with dozens of targets, they'd failed to obtain a single conviction in federal court, beyond the half-dozen defendants who had given up and cooperated, most of them in exchange for avoiding jail time. Richman and Friedberg were so outraged by the case that they filed a motion under an obscure law to force the government to pay their legal fees, claiming that the prosecution had been carried out in bad faith. They ultimately lost, but in a hearing on the motion, Marx's team was forced to admit that their case had imploded. Judge Nelson excoriated the government once again. "Even innocent mistakes, those that result from inexperience or negligence rather than affirmative misconduct, carry real and serious consequences when they involve the immense prosecutorial might of the United States," she wrote. Here, Oz was uprooted from his native country, incarcerated for several months, forced to live in the United States for more than 2 years while subject to intrusive monitoring, and spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on his legal defense. The trial's results, examined from one direction, flipped the entire story of LaRue on its head. The not guilty verdicts arguably prove that LaRue had been right all along when he told his employees that the pharmaceutical business was legal. They suggested an alternate history in which LaRue had been a legitimate businessman, an internet billionaire who earned his fortune through cleverness and persistence. He could have been lauded on the covers of business magazines, not hounded across the world by the DEA. If his ambitions hadn't outstripped RX Limited, if he hadn't chosen to leverage his success into a truly criminal empire, he might never have been worth chasing in the first place. A few months later, I went to see Prabhakara Tempati, who I'd discovered owned a clinic in southern Brooklyn. He'd expanded his business from sleep medicine into obesity treatment, and his basement office in Bensonhurst was bustling with activity. It was the end of a long workday that for Tempati had started with a drive from Pennsylvania, and I sat in the waiting area as he walked out his last patient of the day. "It's not easy, right?" he said gently, of the weight loss regimen he'd prescribed her. "It takes a little bit of convincing." Although I'd never spoken to Tempati during the trial in Minnesota, he'd always struck me as preternaturally cheerful, given the amount of prison time he was facing. Now exonerated and sitting across from me in his office, he was eager to tell me why. He and his family were deeply Christian, he explained, and God had sent prophecies that Tempati would come out pure as gold on the other end of the trial. "This, in fact, has been the best time of our lives," he said. "Everything about this is a miracle, and nobody can believe it. But we can believe it, because it was foretold." Not that there hadn't been nightmarish aspects to the case, he said. He'd lost weeks of work on the trial, putting a strain on his family's finances. The DEA had confiscated his car and never returned it, even as he continued to make payments on it. But he was adamant that he'd never for a moment doubted that the work he'd done for RX Limited was not only legal, but the future of medicine. "It was painful," he said, "to watch it be twisted by the government into a crime. I thought, what am I doing here?" he said. "I'm a church-going family guy, never been in trouble, never been on drugs, always paid my taxes. Suddenly you are the next drug lord, and it's all in the mind of one prosecutor who thinks this is not a valid model. Now every single prescription became a drug deal. Every cent of money became money laundering. Everything that was sent through FedEx became mail fraud. The prosecutors had offered him a deal at one point, he said. Plead guilty and get 10 years in prison. And they were angry when I didn't take it. Those that didn't have belief in the system, or didn't have the means, or the courage, they took deals. Those that stood and fought it came out on top. I'm so thankful that I thought of sending a thank you card to the prosecutor. Really, I'm not telling you this for the story. I'm telling you this because I frankly thought about it. Because we were stronger as a family, we were stronger in our faith than ever before. We were happier, because happiness is internal. Chapter 33. The Investigators, the Reporter, the Mole. 2017. Adding up the winnings. Conspiracies abound. Clausen reaches out. A meeting in Hanoi. The mastermind's fate. The next time I saw Kent Bailey in Minneapolis, 6 months after the ARC's limited trial, he sounded surprisingly sanguine about the verdict. He was furious at his own prosecutors for their mistakes, but he seemed to have long resigned himself to disappointment after he and Brill lost the battle over LaRue with the SOD's 960 group back in 2012. He still believed Moran Oz and the rest of the RX Limited operators deserved to go to prison. The bottom line is that the reason that Kim started on this case was that we knew they were causing harm in the United States, he said. They were using our infrastructure to cause harm to our citizens. Even with the acquittals, dozens of people serving as nodes on the network had faced varying punishments for their involvement in RX Limited. Doctors, pharmacists, and operators like John Wall, who had pleaded guilty in cases from Detroit to Newark to Texas. Bailey's outlook, in a way, aligned with that of Oz and McConnell's defense attorneys. LaRue had been the prize, the one man that didn't warrant a deal. I'm 100% convinced that we are right as rain, Bailey said. And I firmly believe that in New York, they let their personal interests cloud their judgment. He'd seen plenty of deals cut in his career, but LaRue's didn't sit right with him. He had the most information to give, he admitted, but you can't forget that he was the shot caller. He does not deserve to get out. He deserves to spend the rest of his life in jail. Kimberly Brill, true to form, was more diplomatic than her coworker when I asked her how she felt about LaRue's cooperation. If anything, she noted, the acquittals in Minnesota showed the risks that would have come with taking him to trial. It could have ended much worse, she said, as we saw. But she allowed herself a rare moment of disappointment about the way the verdicts had gone. It's ridiculous, she said, because there was a lot of clear evidence of what they were doing, and I don't think that story was conveyed. I don't know if that's a politically correct answer. It was very disheartening. For years, I tried to convince anyone at the Department of Justice to articulate their motivation for cooperating with LaRue and to give me the view from the 960 side of the case. In response, I received a string of variations on no comment. The DEA spokesman in Washington told me in several different ways that none of the agents who'd worked on the sting operations would talk. Even former agents who had worked on the case, when I found a number of them, refused my questions and warned me away from digging too far. You need to be real careful in that you don't want to make yourself a witness, one former SOD supervisor told me. Finally, in early 2018, the DEA allowed me to speak to a former 960 agent who had worked closely on the case. Look, he's in jail and is not killing people he would have killed, the former agent said, sitting across from me at a Brooklyn diner one spring evening, a few blocks from the Marriott that out-of-town DEA agents book when in New York for trials. The Iran and North Korean leads might not have borne fruit, he said, but the likely conviction of four Americans, including two former U.S. soldiers, who would otherwise still be roaming the world as paid assassins, that was significant. Do I think it was worth it? Yeah. Should he get 15 years? Should he get 30 years? Probably everybody who was involved in that operation should get a bullet behind the ear. Seriously, they are not good people. They are never going to be productive members of society, ever. So what's justice? I don't know. I did my job, is how I look at it. The prosecutors who'd worked on the cases refused to speak a public word about LaRue. A spokesman for the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District repeatedly declined to talk, telling me back in 2015 that we have no public record information on LaRue. I got a version of the same answer from the Consumer Protection Branch, where Linda Marks worked. When I introduced myself to Marks one morning outside of a courtroom in Minneapolis, she replied only with a tight smile and a curt no comment. The void left by the government's silence was filled, at least in some corners, by wild theories about LaRue and his exploits. Many of them trickled down to me, and I felt duty-bound to at least consider them. I got emails suggesting that LaRue had been the inventor of Bitcoin, and I wasted countless hours trying to determine if there was any connection. As far as I could tell, there wasn't. A person close to a former employee of LaRue's, now in prison, was convinced that LaRue was part of a larger geopolitical conspiracy. The Clintons, George Soros, etc., etc. And sent me long explanations of how it all tied together. It didn't. Other people contacted me with implausible stories of how they themselves had crossed paths with LaRue, how he'd threatened to kill them, or destroyed their business. You have been fed/led a narrative that has been orchestrated by three-letter alphabet agencies, one of them informed me. When I pressed them for details, they faded away. There's more to the story, they would tell me, and in some sense, they were right. There were always details, people, connections just out of my reach. Even my more reliable sources sometimes threw out rumors they heard, or sent me lists of officials in one country or another who they said had been in LaRue's pocket. LaRue, according to one tale, had been planning to carry out a coup in Zimbabwe. LaRue himself had heard that one. There's a lot of strange shit in that country. There was some rumor that I was planning to overthrow the president by force, he once noted to his cousin Matthew in a 2009 online chat. These people going to get me killed with stupid shit like that. A journalist told me he had evidence LaRue had conspired with a South African security company to move former Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi's stash of gold out of Libya. He even sent me a document purporting to be notes from the meeting in which it was planned. There was nothing to verify its authenticity. But given what I had been able to document, who knew? LaRue had been involved in so many